Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, March 28th. I'm Ray Graff. Well, the huge total solar eclipse is coming. It's coming in a matter of days. Today, we welcome back a couple of astronomers to talk about that and many other things with you. Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson are here to talk astronomy. If you have a question about any of it, give us a call. 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org, or 800-348-2551. Valerie Rapson brought some neat eclipse glasses, and I found out I couldn't read the script at all, even worse than usual. So we took them off, but we'll talk about them after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. It's Astronomy Day today, and as the eclipse gets closer, the excitement builds all around this region for one of the biggest events, perhaps, of our lifetimes. We have today with us Bob Berman, astronomy editor for the Old Farmer's Almanac, an author and a contributing editor at Astronomy Magazine. Dr. Valerie Rapson is here, assistant professor, a professor of physics and astronomy at SUNY Oneonta. If you have a question for these two about the eclipse or anything else in the heavens, give us a call. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. voxpop@wamc.org is the email address, and the number is 800-348-2551. Valerie Rapson, thanks for the glasses.
Yeah. I had to bring them around, you know, show everybody what good non-counterfeit glasses look like and make sure everybody's ready for the eclipse.
And how do you know they're not counterfeit?
Well, you can put them on and look around and make sure, like you said, you can't see anything.
Not
if you
a
see
darn
anything
thing.
But the sun, they could be dangerous. So.
Now, to be clear, if I wanted to, if it was sunny, it's not sunny now. If I wanted to go out and look at the sun, I could put those on and look at it at any time?
Or... Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, we call them eclipse glasses because that's when people normally use them, but they're certified to be safe to look at the sun anytime you want.
Bob, if there was a solar, some sort of a... Not necessarily a flare, but something that came off the sun, and I happened to be looking at it with those glasses, would I see anything like that?
Well, you would. That's what happened with Richard Carrington on September 1st, 1859, when he saw the brightest flare that humans have ever seen. Fortunately, using at that time, they used colored glass, but the same thing. And as you were saying, if people who have eclipse glasses at home and wonder, well, are they safe or are they not? Look carefully, and somewhere on it should be written the words ISO 12312-2. I'll say it again, ISO 12312-2. And that is a standard that recently has been retested by the American Astronomical Society, by an optical group in Australia. And it means, you're going to like this, that you can look at the sun for 25 straight hours with that without eye damage.
That's intense.
Of course, the sun will go down.
Yes, you can't even get 25 hours of looking at the sun. But if you could... you'd be protected for 25 straight hours. So in other words, if you've got glasses that meet that spec, don't even give it a second thought.
So, you know, my concern is safety. And I'm afraid if I put those glasses on and I'm wearing them, they're going to fall off and I'll, you know, singe my whatever's in my eye that burns. Bob, you wanted to talk specifically about safety here. And I know you've been doing some... events and some seminars and whatnot about this. So encapsulate it for us and make sure, aside from the glasses, people know what to do.
Okay. The thing to remember is that the eclipse sun is not more dangerous than the regular sun at all. The issue is staring at the sun, because what can happen then is that part of the sun's rays, and it's not even the visible as much as the UV and the infrared, focuses on once if you stare... One spot on your retina is going to receive all that energy, and the heat is going to build up, and it's a matter of time. A quick look at the sun or the eclipse, Ray, won't hurt you, because we've all, at some point in our lives, quickly glanced up inadvertently or not at the sun, and we've never had any trouble from it because a quick glance of a second or two won't let the heat build up. So if everyone just remembers that the issue is heat building up, they'll know that the issue is staring at the sun. So if there's a section of the sun that you're wondering about, like, for example, some say don't look at the diamond ring part of it because there is a little tiny bit of full sunlight. Well, just ask yourself, am I letting that concentrate? And the solution is often as simple as keep moving your eyeball around. If you want to see it, that part, for example, look away from the sun slightly, but keep your attention on the diamond ring, and then move your eye a second or two later to another spot just outside the sun, and then move your eye another few seconds later. And that way you can keep your attention on it, but as long as you don't stare, you can't do too much damage. And I'm not saying that you should look at all, but that's a thing to keep in mind.
Yeah,
and, of course, never use binoculars on the uneclipsed sun because then all bets are off, and in just a second or so you can damage
and
your
not
eyes.
Even wearing the eclipse glasses, right? Let's be clear. You don't want to use binoculars if you have eclipse glasses
right,
on.
Right, yeah. Don't use them unless the sun is totally eclipsed, and then it's safe. But even then, you have to be careful because you don't want to be pointing the binoculars near the end of totality so that the full sun comes back while you're using the binoculars. So I'd say if you need binoculars, and they're a great tool for small parts of the total eclipse sun, like prominences, those pink flames of fire are sometimes very small, and binoculars can make them better. The key there is only use them in the middle of the eclipse. How do you know it's the middle? Well, wherever you're seeing the eclipse, let's say it's 3 minutes in the region where you are. So look at it first with just your eyes, not the binoculars, for the first half minute or minute. Then bring the binoculars up for only half a minute or so, and then put them down. That way you're only using them during the middle part, and you won't have a danger of the full sunlight coming through the binoculars.
That scares me to death. Now, Valerie, you'll be at Oneonta,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yep.
And I assume that you will you have the telescope out with appropriate filters?
Yeah, we have a bunch of different telescopes there, all that will be outfitted with the solar filter. So we'll have regular white light ones. We also have one of the H-alpha solar telescopes that only let through a little bit of red light, so you can see the flares and the prominences.
Oh, cool.
And like all of the bumps on the surface of the sun, which are really cool. So we're going to have all sorts of different viewing mechanisms, and we won't get totality, so you'll have to have some sort of coverage over your eyes the entire time, but it'll still be really cool to
now
see.
But not when you're looking through the telescope, though, because you'll have filters.
Right. So we're taking care of the filters on
right.
the telescope,
but if
and
you're
then
standing
it's
around.
To
now, yep. How close to you must be fairly close to totality.
Yeah,
there.
We get 97.6% coverage, which is close, but not close enough. We won't get to see the corona or anything, but it is going to get like ever so slightly dark for us. And, you know, it'll feel like it's approaching sunset. It won't get to sunset, but it'll feel as if that's happening.
You know, I was living down, and this must have been in the early 90s at one point. I was living down in Brewster, and mm-hmm. there was an eclipse, and I forget when it was, but it was not a total eclipse, at least where I was. But it did get dark, and it mm-hmm. did get freaky.
Yeah.
And it was probably, I don't remember what eclipse we had in 1992 or 3 or 4.
1994, May 10th.
94, yeah.
Yeah.
That was pretty cool, though. And there's another one coming August 12th, 2045, but it'll be south of here. Like the entire state of Florida is in totality,
mm-hmm.
and I think it goes across the southern Midwest.
And over Disney World, that one.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
So, that'll be, I think most of us have a shot to live that long. So, I mean, if we fail here, you
there
know.
We go.
Number to call here is 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. It's Astronomy Today with Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. Before we get to the email bag and then the phones, there's this nova, and Valerie, you and I went back briefly back and forth about this.
Mm-hmm.
This is a freaky thing. This is not a supernova where everything just goes boom.
Right.
This is a nova. It's a binary star. Explain.
Yeah. I mean, everybody, because of the eclipse coming up, everyone's thinking about like stars and cool things that you can get to see. So we've really been hyping up this idea of looking at T Corona Borealis, this star that is in a binary system. The object is actually a white dwarf orbiting a red giant, and the white dwarf is stealing material from it. And it will soon, we think, reach a point where the surface of the white dwarf gets so hot that it triggers fusion and creates this bright flash of light. And we call that just a regular nova. So you'll see the flash of light, you'll see the fusion essentially happening, but the star doesn't get destroyed like in a supernova. And it won't be quite as bright as a supernova explosion, but it'll be a new star in the sky that we get to see for at least a couple of days.
So it'll be a couple of days. And it'll be bright enough to see with the naked eye?
Yeah, it'll be comparable in brightness to the North Star, about magnitude 2.
Wow.
So pretty bright. Not the brightest thing, but, you know, it'll be noticeable for sure.
Interesting. Now, our number here is 800-348-2551. Before we get to the calls and the emails, you know, we have this devil comet that's up there, and I missed it. I looked. I didn't have a great view to the west, and I tried and couldn't see it. Now, coming up in early April, it's only going to be in the daytime sky. So that's why you can't see it on a normal day or a normal night. When the eclipse comes, will those people who are in totality have a shot to see this comet?
You're looking at me, so I guess I'll answer. Remember, a lot of people think that totality means it'll be like night. It won't. It's not particularly dark during totality. You can always read by the light of the fully eclipsed sun, and only the brighter stars and planets come out. So a comet like this, which is not very bright, you're not going to be able to see that with just the eye.
Well, that stinks. All right, let's take a break. 800-348-2551 is the number. It's astronomy today. Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman, your calls. We'll check the email bag first right after. Great Sonny Rollins and Paradox here. That's our bumper music. It's Vox Pop on WAMC. 800-348-2551 is the number. Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson join us today. Let's do a couple of emails and then to the phones we shall go. This one came in, an hour and a half ago from Justin. Looks like the first polarized image of a black hole in Sagittarius A was released today. Mm-hmm. Could you give a brief explanation of what we're seeing for the layperson?
Yeah, so I saw this too. It looks really cool. You know, viewers might remember that like orange circle where you were actually looking at the black hole in the middle of the Milky Way. It's basically that, but now we can see kind of some lines through it, which are representing the magnetic field. So basically, you're looking towards the black hole. It's surrounded by all of this plasma, this material from stars that are going to eventually fall into the black hole. And there is a magnetic field that flows through this material because it's just, in many cases, free-floating electrons. So if you've got essentially electricity flowing, you're also creating a magnetic field. So we're seeing this. And what we're seeing is what's called synchrotron radiation, which is these electrons that are tossing out photons as they spiral.
Yeah.
So by understanding the magnetic field and how material moves around the black hole, we can try and see if our black hole has an active jet. That's really what they're going
Why for. Is that important?
Well, when we looked at the other black hole, I think it was an M81, I think, if I'm remembering the right galaxy. But that one has like an obvious jet. Basically, it's tossing out material and it tells you about how active the galaxy has been over time and how the black hole has evolved and changed a little bit. So if we can study our own black hole, we can try and understand how much material has fallen in, what's the rate at which it does that type of thing. And so far, we haven't been able to see it, but the magnetic field is cluing us in to those kind of jets.
This indirect evidence is so cool. Bob, I remember seeing, a year or two ago, a picture, and you can't, of course, see the black hole, but what you saw was galaxies and other, I guess, just galaxies that were behind it, that because of lensing, you could see. So explain to me how that works and how we can infer black holes from that.
Oh, yeah, because thanks to the bending of space-time by strong objects of gravity, we're now not using the Einsteinian way of thinking of things, you can get a magnifying or distorting effect, things like the Einstein cross, where something looks like a cross. More likely you get stretched out images Or, this is cool, you could get two separate images of the same thing where the object goes around, has a choice of going around either of two paths around a foreground massive object. So we can figure out how massive the foreground object is. And those jets that Valerie was talking about is just cool to look at. In the one in which Valerie was referring to, an M87, out of the west side of that galaxy, and I've even seen it through our own telescope, and there's something, it's like West Side Story there. It's a story of amazing, in fact, we used to think it was superluminous, faster than light, because it's coming toward us as well as going sideways, and so it gives an illusion of super speed. It's got knots in it, and so the black hole is so powerful. There you're talking about, the last I saw, it was something like 9 billion solar masses of material. Our own galaxy's supermassive black hole, Sagittarius A star, is 4 million. So we're 1,000 times, three orders of magnitude less.
In how big of a volume?
You know, I'm tempted to make, I like making things up once in a while, and I'm tempted to make up a figure, but since I don't have it in my head, I'm not.
It's about the size of the solar system. I've seen some pictures, where they kind of overlay the black hole in like the orbit of Pluto, but ballpark, it's, you know, something the size of our solar system, which is far bigger than our sun and the planets, but you're taking, as Bob said, 4 million times the mass of the sun and squishing it into that space, and that's how you generate these kind of black holes.
You know, among the 4,000 things that keep me up at night, I sometimes worry about the theory of wandering very small black holes. Have we heard anything more about these, and how small are they, and how ubiquitous are they?
I haven't heard much lately about those. I don't think you should stress about them too much.
No, really?
I mean, even the small ones, if one was coming by a planet or something, we would see the effects.
Yeah.
Would we see
that lensing sort of effect?
If it got close enough, yeah, we would be able to see it.
All right, this email from Ryan. What's an eclipse like on a cloudy day?
Oh, it means you've missed it. That happens sometimes to us astronomers. And if you've been around enough astronomers who've been to enough eclipses, you really hear some pretty sad stories, including in Lake there's an eclipse back. I forgot the date, but it was over Lake Baikal, and the Soviet government had set up a special viewing station on an island on Lake Baikal for visiting astronomers. And on the day of the eclipse, because the conditions were supposed to be perfect, two American astronomers overslept and missed the ferry, and they couldn't get out to the island. So they went to the hotel roof, where it was still within the path of totality, saw it quite well. And it turned out that over the island at the perfect site, a single cloud formed, and nobody there saw a single thing, saw anything. So clouds, not good.
This email from all right, I'm going to give you a chance, Bob, to get on your soapbox about this. Uh-oh. Andrew writes, "I live in Albany, and we'll keep it brief. I live in Albany. Do I go up north to get closer to full totality? I feel like I should get into that gray area that is shown on all the maps. How will Albany compare versus being up in the Adirondacks?" 1 minute. Go.
Okay. Well, the thing to remember is don't think in terms of you want maximum darkness, because too many people think, well, the attraction is darkness at noon. And so if you hear that Albany has a 97% eclipse, which we will, by the way, that is the figure for Albany, and you figure that going up north to, let's say, Burlington is 100%, it's reasonable to think, well, it's only 3% darker. Why should I bother with 3%? Always remember that all the phenomena that happen, seeing the sun's atmosphere, seeing the magnetic field, seeing those nuclear geysers of fire, the pink prominences, the coronosphere, all these amazing things only happen at totality. So you're going, not to mention the animals going crazy, the feeling you
get.
Now,
what do you mean going crazy?
I mean,
they're going to attack.
Birds will go to roost. Cows will try to come home. You read all sorts of strange animal things. Half the people who see them weep from the emotional impact. There's no impact in other celestial events, but there's an impact there. So you'll get that if you go to if our caller goes up north to totality. Otherwise, this is interesting. But remember, partial eclipses happen every couple of years. So they're not, whereas a total eclipse in your neighborhood is a once-in-a-lifetime thing.
Hey, you know, you wait to 2045, you go to Disney World, it'll all be good. All right. Now, okay, so we talked about this, and it was the consensus of our astronomers that you should not look at the eclipse with eclipse glasses and binocs, right? And Scott says, don't do it. Don't wear eclipse glasses and look through binoculars. The sun will burn a nice pinhole through the mylar. I found out the hard way.
I'm sorry for him. I also heard about a sad effect of somebody who contacted me at Astronomy Magazine to tell me that his eyes now, decades later, were still damaged from having looked at, in his case, he used binoculars, sweeping the area of the sun looking for Mercury, mm-hmm. and he got too close to the sun and caught a quick glance of the sun, just quickly, and it was enough so that decades later, his eyes are still damaged.
Yeah, I want to say if you check out Suni Oneonta's socials, we are going to post a video of me burning a cow eyeball with a telescope again.
Ooh.
Because, you know, we got to demonstrate what not to do.
What's
as
the URL
we
on
to
that?
Have the fun. It's on all of our social media channels, so you can just search for it and find it. But
yeah, everybody was upset because I thought the cow should have at least been anesthetized before
this
they
was
did
just
that.
Just the eyeball, no worries.
So you took the eye out.
But we literally did. We held it up to the telescope for like 30 seconds and said, you know, watch what happens. And obviously a human would never look this long. You would realize long before your eyeball lights on fire that there's a problem.
Yikes, the eyeball lit on fire?
You can hear in the video the crackling. You can see the smoke and then you can see the actual like burn hole. But
did it smell tasty?
It was gross.
Okay.
I did not want to have lunch after that.
I do like
beef.
But
it was still a lot of fun.
All right, Mike in Rexford writes, and then we'll go to the phones. 800-348-2551. Mike says, I bought the welder's glass plates that you described on earlier shows. Can I safely look at the non-eclipse sun through the piece of dark glass? Now, remember, Bob, I'll give you another minute here, because if you get the wrong glass, you're in trouble.
Yes, you have to make sure that it's a shade 12, 13, and 14. Now, most welders use a 10, use a lighter shade. That's not going to protect you from the sun. On the other hand, there are some websites that wrongly say that only a 14 is safe. That's wrong, because there's been testing now by the American Astronomical Society and by others that show 12, 13, 14 are all safe, but not a shade that's lighter than that. You don't want a 10.
All right. You know, somebody wrote in between shows asking about this, and I found a great website. It's the AAS?
The American Astronomical Society.
And they have a great page on it with all the data you need on that.
Yeah, exactly. They'll say the same thing, yes.
Yep.
All right, the number to call here is 800-348-2551. It's Astronomy with Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman. Ellie's in Newburgh. Hello, Ellie.
Yeah, my question is, we know that the path of totality extends like from Dallas up to Holton, Maine, but what is the width east and west of that path? And maybe Valerie answered that, because maybe Newburgh on the Hudson River might be within that area, maybe 98%. What do you think?
Well, the width, we were chatting about this before, is about 100 miles. I don't have the whole map of New York memorized, but I don't know. Bob, do you know off the top of your head?
No, Newburgh is not even close to totality. Okay. And remember what we said, 98%, and this is a line from Fred Espenak, who creates all those great eclipse maps. He said 98% means 0% totality. So if you're after totality, Newburgh will not do. You got to go north. From here, I'll give you some quick nearby places that are in the path of totality. Burlington, Plattsburgh, Oswego, where there's a state college, Rochester. Further west would take you to Buffalo. These are all in the path of totality. All of Lake Champlain. So any beach in Lake Champlain is you're automatically good.
All right. Kathy writes in. Oh, by the way, Ellie, thanks for the call. Kathy writes in, and I love this. Anyone can print the ISO 12312312-2 filter code on eclipse viewing glasses. Please tell people to check their glasses before using. testing the glasses inside, you shouldn't see anything unless directly looking at a light bulb, and even the light bulb should glow very dimly. Mm-hmm. And then Kathy says, this is from NPR, the American Astronomical Society is warning consumers to check their eclipse glasses before the eclipse. The AAS says you should wear the glasses inside your house, where only bright lights should be dimmed but viewable. If that works, take the glasses outside. You shouldn't be able to see anything other than the sun's reflection on certain surfaces. If either test fails, don't use the glasses. And again, we
good advice.
We sent the, basically it's eclipse.aas.org.
Yeah, right. Good advice. And one more thing, those floppy eclipse glasses, such as the kind that Valerie has just
like
sitting in front of us, they're very nice and they give a nice orange image of the sun. But because they're plastic, they can scratch. And so don't put them in a pocket with keys or something that can scratch them, because that can let the full sunlight through. That's one advantage of the welding glass, because those are glass and the filter is right through the glass from one side to the other. So unless you've somehow broken the glass, you're safe with those.
Right. I wanted to say, too, a common question I've been getting is if people have glasses left over from 2017, are they still good? And as long as they have been kept well, if they actually are the ISO-certified glasses, they are safe. But it's super important to check for those micro tears that Bob was mentioning and everything the person who wrote in said. You really got to check them and make sure that they're good, because you don't want to risk damaging your eyesight.
Yeah, I'm too paranoid for this. I'm going to be watching it online. I'm sure of that in my living room or here at the office, more like. Let's go to Savoy. Nate, you're on.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
I had two questions. You answered one, kind of. I worked in the film industry as a gaffer and a key grip. One of my job duties was tracking the sun and the clouds when you're outside. Mm. And they make this thing called a gaffer's glass, which is really expensive and hard to use. So I used welding goggles. I found that 14 was too dark to see the details of the clouds and stuff. So I used like a 12. And I did it for 5 years, and I had no problem.
It
works.
Yes, and I'm going to support what you just said. In some of our eclipses, we've offered our guests on our eclipse tours a choice. We brought along 12s and 14s and said, try them both on the sun now. And so tomorrow you'll know which one you want to use. You have your choice. We brought lots of both. And everybody preferred the 12s, just like you did, to the 14s, mm-hmm. for the same reason, because they felt that the sun's image was just too dim through a 14.
Yeah.
They're both safe, but the 12s show a brighter image, not unpleasantly bright, but a brighter image that most people prefer.
Yeah, it was just better contrast and stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Nate, go ahead.
Also, I was wondering about photography. I assume with a film camera, it won't matter, but with a digital camera, if I'm photographing it, do I need eye protection to look at the monitor of my camera? And should I have a filter on the lens of my camera? Will I damage the sensor in my camera if I don't have a filter?
All right, Val.
Yeah, you really want to be careful. So you got to have a filter on the front of your camera, because all of the optics inside are going to concentrate the light onto the chip. And you can burn the chip just like you could theoretically burn your eyes. So you definitely want to put a filter on the front of the camera, and then you can look through the screen and see everything just fine.
Here's one advice that keeps getting repeated, because we hear this over and over at eclipses from people who were sorry that they got involved with photography. Now, our caller sounds like you might be a professional photographer or a photographer hobbyist,
yes.
In which case, fine, go to it. That's your interest. But for the average person, we advise not to bother with photography for several reasons. Number one, to make the sun a decent size, and I know the caller knows this, you need a telephoto lens somewhere between 500 and 1,000 millimeters. And too many people have to take the time to change lenses, to change the focus, to bracket their exposure by changing the f-stop, by moving the camera, because the sun is going to shift position during the eclipse. And these are seconds
of the mm-hmm. eclipse that you will not get back. And so we've heard over and over again, oh, I'm so sorry I bothered with the camera. I took half the time of the eclipse fooling with the camera, and I missed the eclipse. Yeah. So unless you're really into photography, let others do it, because they'll be professionals. You know, and after it, you're gonna see beautiful pictures of the eclipse. And we'd say, unless that's your thing, photography, I'd say don't bother.
You know what? That's a great point. And that can be... Now, that is an allegorical point for our entire civilization. So many people are looking for photo ops for the social media that they forget to enjoy the real moments of life. That's why it could be insidious to be on social media, except for the cow eye burning.
Go watch the cow eye video, and then you can get off.
That's good stuff, you know. All right, let's go back to the phones, and Bart is in High Falls. Bart.
Hi. I'm sorry this is not on the eclipse.
That's
this
fine.
Is off the subject. Yeah. I'll call back next
no,
week.
No, go ahead.
I wanted to talk about the expansion of the universe. It expanded for 13.7 billion years. And from one point, does that mean that all the material, all the particles of the universe were located at that one point at one time?
Yes. That's what it means.
Well, holy cow, how can you imagine that? It's beyond comprehension.
I agree. Yeah. Val, what do you think?
It's pretty hard to imagine. And, you know, we're so far past, you know, like you said, 13.7 billion years past that point. And everything is expanding away from everything else. So, like, there isn't really one point to look in the universe and to say, you know, that's where everything used to be and I'm at this point now. It's everything is expanding and moving away. So the Big Bang kind of happened everywhere. But, yeah, technically we were all in one small spot
that
encompassed the whole universe.
Plus.
Okay, so this is just an addenda, then I'm finished.
Okay.
Do they think dark matter is about 70 to 80% of the what we know as matter today?
So yeah, within all of the matter, dark matter is a majority of it, but dark energy is a majority of the universe, and those are different things.
All right, Bart, thanks. We're going to take a break here. The number is 800-348-2551. It's astronomy. Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson are here. Rob writes in, additional eclipse side effect, total eclipse of the heart. We'll get to that on the other side of the break. Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here. Eclipse is coming. We're talking to astronomer Bob Berman and astronomer Dr. Valerie Rapson. And the number to call is 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. And Lawrence writes, what existed outside of the Big Bang singularity, say like 10 feet? Or was it, and is it just non-existence? Could this explain the accelerating expansion of the universe, just a pressure difference between space-time and the void?
Well, technically nothing existed outside of that. I mean, we define the universe as everything that encompasses everything that we know. So there really is nothing beyond the edge of the universe, unless we start to get into these multiverse theories, you know, then we might be able to say something about it. But we really don't know of anything beyond or outside of our universe. It really is all that we know of.
Okay. This is from Pam and Troy. I plan to visit friends in the Path of Totality and spend the night before driving home. However, I'm getting concerned about travel toward the zone the morning of. Based on your experience in other eclipses, should I trespass on my friend's hospitality and drive there Sunday? I would say definitely.
Definitely.
I mean, you know, the traffic's going to be... Governor Hochul was on talking about it.
All the signs driving over here said, warning, eclipse coming,
and that's
traffic.
That's what friends are for.
Right. So impose on them, Pamela. That's a great idea. Number here is 800-348-2551. One more email. This is from Joel. Because of discoveries from the web, a new theory has been proposed that, okay, we've talked about this, that the we didn't talk about it on the air, but we talked about this. Because of discoveries from the web, a new theory has been proposed that the universe is 27 billion years old and that there is no such thing as dark matter. Mm-hmm. Any thoughts? And that's from Joel.
Yeah, it's not technically a new theory, but they're using James Webb data to try and support an older theory, this idea of covariant coupling constants and tired light, which is, you know, a way to explain the expansion of the universe and what's happening with all the light that we see without including dark matter and some components of dark energy, because we don't really know what that stuff is, but we have to make it up essentially to make our universe make sense. So we're trying to tweak the math a little bit, and some of these other theories are trying to use real observations that we have to explain them, but change the math a little bit, which means constants aren't really constants and that light can lose energy. And what they've seen so far is that some of it agrees with the James Webb and the Hubble data, not quite all of it, but we have a ways to go to see if any of this works. But right now, it's not on very strong footing.
Okay, fair enough. Bob?
And one thing we should always remember is that much of this is based on models. Even when we say that the first stars formed 300,000 years after the Big Bang, we're using models because where direct evidence is lacking, we fit it in to the evidence. But we should always remember that these are starter models, and that as more information comes in, we'll know more. Because basically, and this is really the point I want to get to, it's a mystery. The universe is basically a mystery. Yes, there's a lot of data that points to there being a Big Bang 13.8 billion years ago. But even that, let's face it, it says that the universe popped out of nothingness. We have no idea what the antecedent conditions were, how you can get something from nothing, what it means to have a whole universe pop out of nothingness one Saturday morning. And then it expanded far faster than the speed of light for a few millionths of a second. We have a name for it. We say that was dark energy, which still manifests itself in another way. We call it inflation, really. But we don't know why or really what that was. So if you put together the things that we don't know, what does it mean to pop out of nothingness? What does it mean to expand faster than light? What did that? What happened before it? What were the antecedent conditions? And then you throw in the quantum theory guys about consciousness, that the universe and consciousness are correlative, which more and more information is pointing towards. And you really left with a certain amount of humility, or you should be, and realize that basically it's still mysterious. Although we know this and we know that and we know some of the details, if we're pointing towards anything, we're pointing towards one whole being. You see, Valerie and I being observers that observe objects, galaxies, etc., we tend to see the universe as the sum total of all the objects in it, the sum total of the objects. But quantum theory and other areas, especially with EPR correlations, entangled particles, etc., are pointing towards a oneness that connects everything to everything else, and that maybe the better way of thinking of it is as a single entity or a single being, maybe even a conscious being, maybe even an intelligent being that may be eternal. And these are the ideas that are not impossible, but there's so many different ones that are still possible that we should sort of take a deep breath and realize that we really are in our infancy of understanding what this whole thing is about.
All right. We don't know really that much in the grand scheme of things, do we?
No.
I mean, you make up dark energy and dark matter, and then somebody says, well, the universe is twice as old as we thought. Mm-hmm. And really, what do we know?
Right.
We don't know that much.
Still gotta keep looking.
Let's go to Hawpog. Oh, okay. It's Paul. You're on. Go ahead.
Hi, Ray. How you doing?
Good. You're on.
So far, we've been talking about lenses that would take care of the too bright a sun coming down as you're looking at it. When we said the last one was 93?
I don't even know if that was. I don't think that was a total eclipse in 93. 94,
May 10th. That was an annular eclipse. It was annular in Albany, but it was deeply eclipse, 99% in Brewster where you were.
Yeah, exactly. It was pretty cool. So anyway, go ahead, Paul.
I was here. I was on Long Island, and I was at a customer's house, and I wanted to see this thing, but didn't have any glasses or anything else with me to look at it. So what I did was I took a piece of paper to act as a screen, and then used my reading glasses to project just the shapes.
Sure.
You couldn't really see much more than the shape, but you could actually see the sun moving across the Earth's shadow moving across the sun, or the moon's shadow.
Yeah, it was pretty cool.
Whichever one it was.
Yeah, projection devices are a great thing to use.
Just a projector type thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, whether you have lenses or you literally just, you know, crisscross your fingers and kind of make a hole, you can get it to project on the ground. So there's a lot of easy ways to do it. The temptation is to look up with your actual eyes.
Don't do it.
Yeah, you can see those projections all around
it, right.
You.
Hey, Paul, thanks for the call. I remember during that 94 eclipse, I did the old elementary school, middle school trick. I made a box and put a hole in it and looked at the trying to get my head in the box. I did something a little wrong, but I did happen to see it. And I remember that there was some effect on the leaves and the shadows. And I can't remember exactly what it was, but the shadows were different.
Yeah. Because every space between the leaves, as long as there are leaves on a tree, all those little openings between the leaves are casting on the ground normally little images of the sun. You might have noticed that in the shade beneath trees, you don't see the shapes of the holes between the leaves. You see round shapes, and what you're actually seeing are sun images that are being cast as if they were pinhole cameras created by the leaves.
Yeah.
So when an eclipse is underway, they become crescents at a certain point in the eclipse. And so you see lots of crescents under that. And I've got to tell you that in the old days, there was all sorts of things that were used. For a while, we used CD-ROMs. You'd look through CDs, and they blocked the light. In my grandparents' time, glass was smoked with a candle flame, and they looked through it, and they didn't go blind. I'm not recommending it, but I'm saying that was used. In the 19th century, colored glass, deeply colored glass, was routinely used for looking at the sun. So over the centuries, all sorts of things have been used, most of which wound up being okay. We wouldn't recommend them today because there's UV and infrared, and you don't know how long you can use them, and they're not inspected, and they don't go by the ISO standard. But
I would try to avoid that, boys and girls, if possible, because we don't know how the eyesight was in the old days when they did this.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. And from a legal standpoint, I'd say don't do it. Go to eclipse.aas.org if you have any questions about this stuff. Michelle in Dutchess County, you're on.
Yes. I was wondering if I can take a picture with my phone.
Sure. Just take those eclipse glasses and put them in front of the lens first.
Oh, on an iPhone or an Android?
Yeah.
It won't look like much because an iPhone actually makes images a little smaller than in real life, and you'd actually want the sun to be much bigger. That's why we use telephoto lenses to look at the eclipse sun.
Right.
Through your iPhone, it'll be a dot. It won't really look like much, but go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And you can practice ahead, too.
Thank you.
You don't have to do it during the eclipse day as the first trial. Like, if it's sunny today, go outside if you've got the glasses and test it out so that if you want to change any settings, you know what to do.
You know what? I'm going to try that. Hopefully, I won't fry my phone, but I'll try. So if there were, you know, the sun's been crazy active lately, and if there were sunspots, would I see, if I put the eclipse lens over my iPhone camera lens, would I in fact see the dark spots where the sunspots are happening?
No, because it's too small. You'll get an image that's too small, way too small.
Yep.
All right.
But otherwise, with the projection mechanism, sometimes you can get a big enough picture to see it. Or if the sunspots are big enough, just right through the glasses, sometimes you can see a little black dot.
That's so cool. All right. We're going to go to Richard in Rensselaer. Richard, you're on.
Hi. I'd like to know, will we be able to see Mercury during the eclipse?
That's a good question. Bob, how close is Mercury to the sun?
That's a great question. I've not done a simulation of that because that lies outside my interest. So Again, I'm going to, though I'm tempted to make something up, I'm not going to do it.
I know for sure I've seen everyone talking about Venus and Jupiter because they're brighter. I just never remember how close Mercury is to the sun and how bright it's going to appear. So it may or may not be visible.
Yeah,
you still have to be in totality regardless.
And Mercury does a funny thing because Venus is at its brightest when it's on our side of the sun and it looks like a crescent, but it's a big crescent, and that's when it's at its brightest. But when it's on the far side of the sun and it's a full Venus, it's at its dimmest. Mercury does the opposite. When it's on the far side of the sun and it's a full Mercury, that's when you get the really bright Mercury. I mean, it can get to magnitude -2. It can get really bright. But it's does the whatever the opposite of what Venus is, that's what Mercury does.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's dispatch Richard. Thank you for the call. And we'll go to Hartford. Barry, you're on.
Hi there. I have a question about theories and proof of theories. A couple of minutes ago, you said that the whole universe kind of started from one point. And I wish sometimes that scientists would say, well, that's just a theory because we never proved it. We never proved how fast light went because we don't have the tools to do it. And I believe in scientists and science so much. Sometimes I get confused as that, you know, I wish they would lean more on telling me whether they have proof or whether it is just a theory. I don't know if that's
Hang on. Something happened with the phone. Barry, I think you're still on. Hang on a minute. Barry, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Something happened. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, there's supposed to be a question there, and I'm not so sure. But I think
we heard that.
So when scientists talk about theories like the Big Bang Theory, what they are really referring to is an idea that has been solidly tested before. So we do have evidence, observational evidence that suggests that, you know, the universe is expanding, that the speed of light is a constant. And we can use tools to physically measure some of this stuff in a lab. We can measure the actual speed of light. You can actually do a little experiment in your microwave at home with marshmallows, which is lots of fun.
You got cow eyes and marshmallows.
I do all these fun things.
Yeah.
But you can get a, you know, basic idea of the speed of light based on the frequencies in your microwave. But what the main point is, you know, the way we use the term theory means a well-tested scientific idea. And we rarely say fact because science always changes. We always learn more. We can always do better. So we leave them as theories so that we can continue to improve and constrain our understanding of the universe.
And let me add that I don't like the Big Bang. I would prefer Fred Hoyle's idea of a steady state and a universe that's eternal and always looks the same. But there is so much evidence for it. Just the simplest is the fact that the farther you look, the faster things are expanding. So it's easy to extrapolate in reverse and see that for every million light years of distance, things are moving 13 miles per second faster. So since the speed increases with distance, you just play that in reverse and see that everything had to be in one place at one time. And that's there's really no getting around that. But if you needed more proof of it, theory tells us that should have also produced a microwave background, a background that's now cooled to microwave wavelengths of 2.73 degrees Kelvin equivalency in temperature. And we do see that everywhere. We also should have a ratio of hydrogen to helium to lithium that we do see everywhere. And so, and there's an anisotropy, which means a variation of only one part in 50,000 coming from all parts of the sky. And so you take everything together and it's hard to get away from there having been a Big Bang, even though I wish we could, but we can't.
All right. And somebody wanted to know how big that initial point was.
Oh, like of the microscopic. We're talking, you know, quantum scales, technically. We had
so all of the matter and energy of the universe
was. And this is not a complete theory. This piece, that very initial instant, is still very much a mystery, but all things point to the fact that if you run time in reverse, it's just going to keep shrinking really small.
All right, so turn my mic back on. That's a good idea. Valerie, if people want to see the grand video of the eye being burned, let us know. How do we do that?
Yes. check out the SUNY Oneonta socials or go to suny.oneonta.edu, and it'll all get posted there throughout our website.
That's exciting, and have fun and be safe out there.
I'm so excited.
Bob Berman, you're all set for your trip to Texas. When are you going to Texas?
On next Tuesday.
That's exciting stuff. If people want to find your comings and goings and some of your tours, how do they do that?
Just say Bob Berman Tours, and that will throw them to the real
place. Don't just say that. You have to put
it into a... You have to type that .com, and then it'll send them to the real place.
Click your heels three times and
Alexa,
say...
Ask Alexa, right?
There you go. All right. Well, thank you both. Support comes from We Clean Heat Pumps, serving the region with cleaning and maintenance of ductless mini-split heat pumps and PTAC to help purify air, capture mold, dust, and debris as heating season is here. WeCleanHeatPumps.com. And the Albany Pine Bush Preserve, presenting their Earth Day event with volunteer projects for children, adults, and community groups Saturday, April 20th from 9 to noon. AlbanyPineBush.org. You see, I put on my eclipse glasses for a moment and I couldn't read the underwriting. There you go. Thanks again to Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson for being here. Thank you for listening. Thanks for the calls and the emails. Sorry if we didn't get to yours. We do astronomy once a month on this program. Thanks to engineer Zach Malloy, phone screened by Susie Checkey. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow at 2 p.m., it's Food Friday, and we talk sensible, healthy, tasty eating with our pal, Nicole Rodriguez. That's tomorrow at 2. We'll see you then.